Our Lady of Akita. When did it happen? What is it about? And more importantly, how does it relate to Our Lady of Fatima and the threefold secret? Today with me is Timothy Gordon, and we're going to discuss Our Lady of Fatima and Our Lady of Akita and see if we can bring some more clarity about the third secret of Fatima based on what we see in Our Lady of Akita, because we know that Cardinal Ratzinger reported that the message of Our Lady of Akita in Japan is the same as that of the third secret. So we're going to be doing some compare and contrast and bring some light to it. Timothy Gordon, my co-host, welcome back. Give us some facts on Our Lady of Akita for people who have never heard of it.
First fact, it's a great apparition for the building of personal faith, and, you know, the continuation of the personal faith, and for anybody interested in Marian apparitions, this is a key one that gets overlooked some, or traditionally, historically has been overlooked some. It's getting a little more of its due, I would say, in the last couple of years. So I like that much. The seer in the case of Our Lady of Akita is a Japanese nun named Sister Agnes Sasagawa. Sister Agnes, was deaf at the time that the trifold apparitions began. It began in 1973 in the summer. She was deaf. She'd been deaf in one ear her whole life, I think her left ear. She began going deaf in her right ear, some people say related to the apparitions themselves. Other people say no. But before July 6th, 1973, which was the date of the first apparition at Akita, she was deaf in both ears. That much is certified. And ended up, and she'd been to Lourdes, which is interesting, and had tried Lourdes and with some measure of success for her deafness. But so the reason that her personal, physical limitations play into this is because she received temporary grace from Our Lady of healing. Nevertheless, so she was a converted Buddhist. She's from a Buddhist family, Japanese family, and really, really, particularly many of them are, all of them are really, but a beautiful example of a convert to Christianity. Whereas you contrast Sister Agnes with Sister Lucy from Fatima, and Sister Lucy was just what you would look at as a great cradle Catholic, right? An ideal cradle Catholic. Sister Agnes is a great convert and a beautiful, just a beautiful story. Anytime I look into her biographical information a little bit. In the case of Akita, though, this is the last bit of setup I'll give. I'll kick it back to you. Is the interesting thing here is it's not like a illuminatory vision or anything like that, like it at Fatima. It's a physical object. It's a wooden Japanese styled statue of the Madonna. And that's where the locutions were coming from. And that's where the message, the three part message came from. So it's really a different one. It's like the Japanese version. It's like, have you ever seen The Ring, you know, the horror movie? Well, look at its Japanese counterpart, Ringu. You know, this is the Japanese counterpart to Fatima. There's a lot here, too. There's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, I had never really heard of it. And what sparked my interest was the message of Our Lady of Akita that prophesies that bishops will be against bishops.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that later in the show. Because we've kind of seen that happening, this de facto schism in the Catholic Church, really since the 1970s, post-Vatican II. Yes. And so it's interesting to see that this apparition happens in 1973, and it relates to not just something that's apocalyptic, but to schism, apostasy, heresy in the church, and the hierarchy quarreling.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a big deal. And it's way out east. It's in Japan. And I'll put a picture of Our Lady of Akita there on the screen so everybody can see what we're talking about. And you can see that Our Lady of Akita, it is Asiatic. And I'm also going to add to this too. I'm not a huge, I am a huge Marian apparition fan. I love Fatima, Lourdes, Guadalupe, been there twice, got the mug. But generally, when it comes to Marian apparitions, I'm a skeptic. If they're not approved and they're not on the church's calendar, I really have no time for them. I'm like, let's read the Bible. Let's read Thomas Aquinas. Let's go read Augustine, church fathers, Cappadocian fathers. We have all the stuff that we know is legit, and it's going to take me 80 years to read and understand and study.
Yeah.
So why would I go and chase some Marian apparition that came out last year in such and such a place? You could waste precious time studying a false prophecy. So I just want to say that I'm generally a skeptic, and I would encourage other people to take that position. But as I read Our Lady of Akita and I see the approvals, maybe I should just mention those real quick, Tim, before we move on.
I think so.
Yeah, just so people don't turn this off as crazy. Let's see. So it was first consulted and proposed in 1975. And in 1984, it was declared that it didn't have any elements which are contrary to the Catholic faith. That was the local bishop, and a number of other statements, basically stating that this is a private revelation that is, it's not a public revelation, it's a private revelation that's worthy of our attention.
Yeah.
Again, this is not dogma. You, as a Catholic, are not required to believe in this. It's a private revelation. But there's nothing sketchy, you know. Sister Agnes, you know, wasn't getting rich off of this, or, you know, there wasn't disobedience and things you see like in Medjugorje or anything like that. This all looks like holy people seeing holy things, talking about holy things for the edification of other believers. So
that's right.
I give it a thumbs up.
That's right. And Cardinal Ratzinger did as well when he was in charge of the Holy Office.
Ratzinger's a fan.
Yeah, so that's really important. On the other Marian apparitions, the non-approved ones, you're going to get at least, you know, 6 or 8 people in the comm boxes.
Or 30.
Energized. Or 30. Angry, why don't you accept, you know, whatever, Our Lady of All Nations or Blessed Catherine Emmerich or whatever. We're not saying they're false, right? It's just, there's, I like Dr. Marshall's point about there's only so much time in the day. And so when one consults Marian apparitions as a source of sort of borrowed faith, right? Because that's what we're doing. That's what a private revelation is. We're borrowing against this gift given to the seer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have to use only the highest, most soundly vetted ones. And Akita, they're, used to be people in the 80s that would try to challenge its credibility. It is beyond reproach, as it turns out. That's why we're dealing with it. We're not saying that every non-approved apparition is fake. They might be real, but they're not really worth your belief until verify. Trust yet verify, as Reagan famously said, right? So it's not that. It's a philosophical verification problem. They might be real, but they're only valuable after we know they're real.
Precisely. And in the valid and authentic Marian apparitions, the Blessed Virgin Mary, or if it's another saint or Christ, always ask the seer to verify the vision or the message with the local ordinary, with the church. Right? So Our Lady never comes down and says, hey, let's rebel against the hierarchy.
Let's take over. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Even at Fatima, we don't see that, which is one of the most hardcore ones, you know. So, again, I think we're on solid ground here. So let's take a look at the messages, shall we?
Let's. Sure.
Okay. So you got the first one there, Tim.
Like word for word, the first message I think is less. It's an interesting structure because
I've got it. Let me. That will be
okay. Yeah.
It's basically the very similar to what Our Lady says in the first Secret of Fatima. That's what's interesting too about this is they parallel the three secrets of Fatima. So the first secret of Fatima was the vision of hell. Basically, pray the rosary, do acts of penance. And here in Akita, she says, pray much the prayers of the rosary. I alone am able still to save you from the calamities which approach. So it's a salvation and it's a pray the rosary message.
Which is an interesting feature. I alone am able to save you from the calamities. Again, pray to Jesus through Mary. This is Our Lady, mediatrix of all graces and the meekest woman on earth. And you see this time and time again throughout the scriptures. This is her claiming herself in a superlative equipoise, right? This is her saying, I am the most at something. I am the most able at this point. I'm uniquely able at this point to offer you help with regard to my son. So I think that sticks out, not in terms of contradiction, but just in terms of being a superlative. She is, remember what you're always saying, she leads with hell in Fatima. That means something, which it does. I think this means something here, that we are now, whatever it is, 46, 56 years after Fatima. And we have Our Lady like, all right, I read it as, you didn't listen to me. Whereas before, the father was angry and my son wants this. Now she's saying, it almost sounds like they're more angry, or now even the son's angry. Now you have to go, you're relying on me in an even more, prime way.
I know that I'm surprised in the comments of all the Protestants who are watching our videos, Tim. And having been a Protestant, I know that this is going to make their hair stand on end, because we have language which seems soteriological, salvation based, and Our Lady is placing herself as the subject, the one to save. And so I want to camp out on that just a moment, to explain what that means, because people, I think, could freak out about this. And even Catholics could say, well, wait a second. Our Lady is, I'm still able to save you from the calamities which approach. Isn't that the role of God? So, of course, we don't believe Mary is God or a goddess. We believe she's a human. She is the highest human, but she is the means by which Jesus enters the world. And Jesus didn't just put her off after she delivered him. He included her as part of his sacred ministry all the way to the cross. Remember, she stood there. The apostles, except for John, ran away. Mary is there praying, and she knows her son is the Son of God, and she knows that he's innocent, that he's sinless. And so in this moment, she knows that he's making a Passover sacrifice for us.
Right.
And she's okay with that, even though it hurts her. So she's brought into this mystery, and she's there at Pentecost again, praying with the apostles when the Holy Spirit comes down. So she's quietly present at all the key moments of the actions of our salvation. And so that's why, the church fathers will talk about, and use language like mediation, intercession, and even salvation.
Right.
Because look, if Jesus didn't have body and blood, it was like the Logos hovering in front of a cross. That does nothing
for our salvation. It contradicts the point of the incarnation.
Yes.
The point, in a certain sense, it props up one of the forms of Arianism, monophysitism, right? If Jesus was just a hovering Logos spirit thing
without a body, then
that's not the embodied second person of the Blessed Trinity. The whole point, Protestants out there, that what you always miss, is that for Jesus to be fully incarnate as fully man, you guys accept the Council of Nicaea as much as we do, basically. He's fully God and fully man. That means he has a fully human mother that was requisite. And they'll say, well, but she's not the mother of God. She's the mother of man. Yes, no. Except those two natures are, what are the other councils right around Chalcedon? They're inseparable.
Yeah, they're united.
They're, there, because his two natures are there, which no one dickers with, no Christians dicker with, and then they're united, that unites and solidifies Mary's role as
the mother of God.
Mother, and she's a soteriological sine qua non.
Yes,
because she is needed in order for him to become an ensouled body, like a human body, like us.
And his ontological connection with all of humanity and you and me and everybody watching, he is connected in his humanity to us through Mary.
Right.
I mean, God could have just, you know, gone into the garden somewhere and formed a human body and made Christ incarnate in that body.
Right.
But that humanness that God created out of a second time, if he did, hypothetical, would not be genetically connected to any of us. It'd be a new thing. So God, in his wisdom, he derived the humanity of Jesus. He assumed it through the Virgin Mary, from the Virgin Mary.
Right.
The heretic Valentinius in the early church, he said that Jesus came to us through Mary like a straw you drink through. So he just kind of passed through like a tunnel. But the Catholics said, no, Jesus actually was born from the Virgin Mary. He derived his humanity from her DNA, from her egg, from her flesh.
Right.
He looked like the Virgin Mary. So that's what we're saying here. And, you know, there's a passage in Scripture where St. Paul says that, you know, he becomes all things to all men so that he might save some. Now, if Paul, the apostle, who is very Christ-centered, says that he can save some, why wouldn't even more so the Blessed Virgin Mary be able to say that? Even preachers or priests could say, yes, through the sacraments, I save people, or through my preaching, I save people, or people were saved at, you know, our meeting or whatever. We can say that, but we don't mean it in an absolute way. We mean it in a relative way. We mean God used me as an instrument to bring his salvation to another person. What is the greatest instrument that God has ever used to bring salvation to planet Earth? The Blessed Virgin Mary. Like you said, she's the sine qua non.
Yeah, we don't mean it. We only would mean it in when we speak of the Godhead in a primary immediate sense. But in a secondary immediate sense, yes, even effective evangelization, which you're pointing out with St. Paul, is you going, hey, did you save that guy? Yeah. I mean,
or a priest hearing a confession.
Right.
He could say that he is saving people. He's, you know, he's bringing them out of sin, out of hell.
He's kind of doing both. Because he's acting in personam Christi, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be the primary sense. And then him as a man being like, I want to pull in extra hours with his own goodwill. I want to do extra confessions tonight so I get into personam Christi extra hours tonight. That's the secondary sense. That's his, that's an interesting concept. But I mean, the precise reason, I like where you're going with this, Dr. Marshall, the precise reason that evangelical American Protestants have been very good at being evangelical, which gives them part of their titular now. I'm not sure how much they own it, but they're called evangelical because they're good at evangelization and because they believe we need to go out and save souls.
Yes.
This is God's action, but it comes through the vehicle of you and your goodwill. This is true at a higher level with Mary. It's just not that complicated. You know, if you save someone who is drowning, then it's the same context, right? It's really the Lord who wishes all good things. That is the formal and final cause of that good action. But it's still fine for you to say, hey, I got a medal. I jumped in and I saved someone from this steamboat wreck, like in Huck Finn, you know, like that's not misleading to say. You're just, we don't always speak in terms of ontological primacy, which it's deeper, but it's confusing and it doesn't attach to everyday life more. So Mary is being just direct and speaking in the everyday secondary sense, which is how most people speak. I am still able to save you from the calamities with which approach. I alone. She doesn't mean I alone with respect to God. She means I alone with respect to
the calamities. Yeah, the calamities. You know, an analogy that helps us understand this is when it comes to Christmas time, my kids want to get gifts for their mom, my wife, Joy.
Right.
And so I take them to the store. I pull out the money, right? I bring it home. I wrap it. I put the tag on it. And then for the little ones, I write their name on there, from Elizabeth. And then on Christmas morning, they walk over super excited and hand the gift to my wife, Joy, and say, I got you a present, mommy. And she opens it and she gets the hug. Well, you know, is it true that Elizabeth got her a present? Absolutely, it is true. But all the causality, except for the little instrumental part of carrying it over to the mother, was me.
That's right.
I drove there. I paid for it. So I did all the work. And that's very much in the economy of grace, how things work in salvation. God chooses to use his little infants, his little children, to bring messages of salvation to one another in a big way through the sacraments, in a smaller way, just through conversations and friendships.
Yeah.
And in the Catholic Church, we understand that the efficient cause and the final cause is, you know, remotely, it is God always. But God loves to use instrumental causality. He loves to use people as instruments. That's just who he is. He could save everybody directly through an apparition of Jesus Christ that appears in their bedroom at midnight. He could do that to every single person in humanity. He has chosen instead to use human instruments to bring about the message of Jesus to the whole world. And sometimes we do that well, sometimes we do it horribly. But you have examples of St. Patrick. You can say, St. Patrick saved Ireland.
Right.
We know it was Jesus. We know it was the Holy Trinity, right? You know, and maybe there was another missionary there that was helping Patrick. So we know that there's other auxiliary elements to it. But it is accurate to say St. Patrick once saved Ireland.
Right. Did he travel there in a boat? Because it was also the boat. It's like, well, yeah, but that's not how people talk. You don't say St. Patrick and his little boat who traveled.
You actually could say that. You could say that the captain helped saved Ireland, if you want. He could say, hey, I was part of that team, you know, part of the Patrick Ireland team.
Of course.
And in the Catholic Church, we understand that when you lose your car keys and you say, St. Anthony, help me find my car keys, he's not operating distinct or broken off from the beatific vision.
That's right.
He's getting the info on the keys and helping you out, we believe, because he's talking to God. He sees God. And in God's omniscience, he can see your car keys are under the bed.
Incidentally, quick sidebar here. So you said you usually don't have your younger kids do the crappy kid rap job. I go with the crappy kid rap job.
No,
usually.
We have crappy kid.
I do everything else. See,
but here's the deal. I have these twin daughters that are teenagers, and they do everything beautifully. So if there's anything crappy going on, they would come in and they would just make sure it looks good.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact,
that sounds efficient.
The crappy rap job is actually me. I usually do the crappy rap job.
I can handle the kiddie crappy rap job.
Right, I
got that locked. Yeah.
Well, you're just adding more of their own instrumentality into the process, which is good.
That's right.
It's very divine-like of you to do that.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay, so that's the first message. We had a lot to say over two sentences. And then, of course, pray the rosary. You know, the rosary is the gospel and beads. The most important part of the rosary is not saying the Our Father or the Hail Mary, the Glory Be. It's the meditation on the mysteries.
Yeah.
You know, it's meditating on, you know, Christ in the garden, praying, sweat, drops of blood, scourging at the pillar, crowning with thorns, carrying the cross, crucified, like spending 15, 20 minutes just camping out in these mysteries changes your heart and your mind, makes you a better disciple of Jesus Christ. And so the rosary is a form of if you want to use modern language, guided meditation. Your guide is the Blessed Virgin Mary, and she's saying, hey, let's walk through what my son went through, and you be there with him. And you do that every day, it starts to change you. If you do a guided meditation with the rosary, you become a better person. You become a saint.
And just for the sake of focus, I like to try to, I don't know, this is almost an interesting topic. to open up. I do, just because I've done so many rosaries now over the last 2 to 3 years when I've really been trying to do it daily, that I'm trying to focus on a detail that I haven't thought about before. So I'm like, yeah, on the Jesus, you know, carries the cross. I'm trying to think of another character that's covered somewhere in the Gospels from whose perspective I can consider it. So yeah, it's all about the meditation. Again, another thing Protestants don't get.
Yeah, it's like putting yourself in the movie, to use a contemporary way of speaking.
Right.
You're at the foot of the cross, and it's like, well, this time I'm going to pretend that I'm John.
Right.
Or this time I'm going to be a centurion. Or this time I'm going to be a Jewish priest and think about it, how they're experiencing what's going, or the thief on the cross. You know, so you can kind of play with it in your imagination and interact with Christ from all these different perspectives. And, you know, as a Protestant, before I knew about the rosary, you know, we read the Bible and we knew the stories and all that, but that intimate way of interacting with Christ through the scenery, like I said, being in the movie, is really helpful. It's really profound.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah. Second message, Tim, should we do that?
Let's do it.
All right, you got it, or do you want me to read
it? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This one makes me laugh a little bit. People, bear with me. You know, I like to find the humor where it might not have been intended. Our Lady says, many men in this world afflict the Lord. I desire souls to console him, to soften the anger of the Heavenly Father. I wish with my son, it's that language, for souls who will repair by their suffering and their poverty for the sinners and ingrates. Now, what, there's not really anything funny here, and I'm a weirdo or whatever I just said. I think it's funny. I just like the opening line, right? Like, many men in this world afflict the Lord. So many men piss the Lord off is basically what she said. Many men bother my son. Like, you bother me.
Yeah.
I just think it's fun. I think it's kind of a hilarious phraseology. And she means it literally, though. So there's nothing funny about it. It's all the more serious that she means this angry, kind of terse, brusque phraseology, to use a term Pope Benedict would always use. She uses it literally. She's not trying to be funny. So it makes it actually unfunny. You know, a lot of people that are living right now are really, really making my son really upset.
Yep.
That's not good. This does not end well.
Yeah.
Right. Without close matching of her words, mimicking of what she's saying to do.
Yeah. Do you think that, again, I'm just thinking of skeptics again, as I hear these things. So often we hear now that, you know, Jesus is tender. He is the mercy, the King of mercy. I believe all those things 100%. But what we don't hear is the expansion of that, that he is merciful in light of justice. In other words, there is a hell, there is damnation, people go there, etc. Jesus doesn't want any of us to go there, so he's doing all these things to ensure our salvation. So again, like we saw in Fatima, we see here, Our Lady's pretty frank.
Doesn't mince words.
You know, you might expect Mary to come down and just give everybody hugs. Like, we need hugs. I'm in a hug ministry. Blessed Mother coming down, just giving everybody hugs. No, she's
or
coming.
High fives.
Or high fives. I'm okay. You're okay. And what we see, I mean, this is the woman, the mother who stood at the foot of the cross and watched her son devastated. So she's coming to the world and she's like, will you stop afflicting my son, scourging, whipping, spitting on him, punching him, pressing the crown of thorns in his forehead? Will you please?
With your sins.
Yeah.
With your sins.
Exactly. Will you please knock it off? And she's saying, yes, Jesus is merciful. He's tender, but people are going to hell and men are afflicting him. They are hurting him. Will you please just knock it off? Stop. Stop sinning.
Maybe it would be potent at this moment to put up that meme I sent you. I think it's hilarious, of the high five.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
okay, let's put it up on the screen. There it is.
It was big a couple weeks ago with the you know, what you really need is a helping hand, which is in the metaphorical context here.
Yeah.
You're drowning and someone just gives you a high five and you go down. That's what critics actually want. That's what critics actually want Mary to do. They're like, why doesn't she just high five us as we drown?
Yeah.
No, she's here to tell you. Just spoke to Jesus.
He doesn't like that.
He's not happy. Yeah. He doesn't like this. You're almost out of luck. This is your last chance, right? Yeah. Like you do with your kids.
She says, here's some solutions. Let's fix it.
Right. Right. She doesn't say he's really, really mad and
you're screwed.
She doesn't say Jinx. That. She's like, he's really mad. Here's what to do. Here, as a matter of fact, this is the ground for my apparition here today with you all. So yeah, I guess it's difficult to not be a broken record and to be harping on something that at the same time, you know, people are missing in popular preaching,
yes.
Popular homiletics, even, you know, the papal homiletics, they're all missing this. So it's like, yeah, we say it a lot, but what do you want from us? You know, this is
right.
This is what you have to do, because people don't understand that mercy does not exist in contradiction with justice, with God's justice. Jesus is merciful because of, with reference to God's justice. He doesn't say, I'm going to abolish the game for you. The game is on, baby.
Yep.
That is that directly from which gospel is that from? The game is on, baby. The rules are there and they're there for all of us. And no one's bigger than the moral rules, the Decalogue, the natural law, you know, the gloss Jesus put on all these things. The mercy and the graces are there to help us win, but he's like, my Father in heaven will be paying attention to who is winning and who is losing. There's still a dub and there's still an L,
yes,
that will be accorded to each person.
Yes, absolutely. Love that. And then in the end here in the second message, she says, I wish with my son. So we see here as a companion of Jesus, which is great, for souls who will repair by their suffering and their poverty for the sinners and ingrates. And I was just thinking in my mind, okay, the second message of Fatima was, of course, pray the rosary, do penance, but also the consecration of Russia she asked for, and that the Holy Father will suffer many things. So we see this whole idea of making a consecration and also embracing suffering. It's a little loose. I realize it's not a one-to-one, but the theme is still there. I wish with my son. So there's this idea of her being consecrated within or alongside Jesus. And then for souls who are going to volunteer, like Sister Agnes, who receives these visions, these words rather, to suffer and to take on poverty for the sake of sinners and ingrates.
I like that.
And I think all of us right now, Tim, me, everybody watching or listening through iTunes, or however you're consuming this, am I willing to be one of those people? And it doesn't necessarily mean that you walk through the streets and flog yourselves or you wear a hair shirt 24/7. If you're a mother, it can be as simple as waking up with the children and tending to them and offering that as a beautiful sacrifice to the Lord. Feeding the hungry, you know, maybe the kids are up at 5 a.m. on Saturday morning and you wanted to sleep in. You wake up, you make them breakfast, you fed the hungry.
I just fed the hungry.
Yes. Yeah. You know, that's just for mothers and for dads, you know, the going to work and all the things you do for the priests who are like, man, I don't want to go sit in a confession again for 3 hours, but they do it for love of God. So sometimes in our Catholic imagination, we go to the extremes and we think, well, I need to sit on top of a pillar for 90 days or I need to wear a hair shirt.
Right.
Or I need to pray and get the stigmata. And some of these, you know, we're talking about the 0.0001% of what we read in the lives of the saints. But for most of us, it's just doing our daily duties with a spirit of joy and a spirit of sacrifice, spirit of service, and offering those in prayer to Jesus as sacrifices, not only for ourselves, but for other people, you know, for those who need redemption. They need mercy.
Yeah, I like the point a lot. It's sort of counterintuitive to put it this way. While we know that it's true, not everybody, people hopefully are getting into heaven without wearing hair shirts, because I've never owned one, not in years, not since the 70s.
Christmas idea. Stephanie, if you're listening, you want a hair shirt for Christmas.
Please, they're just good fashion, people. So I guess I'd never thought about it in the stark terms you just spoke about it, Dr. Marshall. Like, people better be getting into heaven without wearing the hair shirts and with self-flagellation and all of that, because I don't do either of those things and I never have. So it makes the point kind of like a championship basketball team. Like we tend to talk about, you know, the only winner is the finals MVP, the best player on the winning team. And that's because we're not socialists, right? It's most interesting to talk about them. Same thing. It's most interesting to talk about the Saints, not a couple guys, you know, raising their families, wearing regular shirts, Under Armour, right. I guess. But except the rest of the team has a job to do, and to discharge the duties of your job well, even though they're less glorified in this sense, it's anti-glorification, but even though they're less grabby than the MVP's job, you know, is still a make it or break it distinction. You still either discharge your suburban or urban or rural duties to your family or to your flock if you're a priest well or unwell, and you're judged on the whole. So I really like what you're saying there with respect to the second part of the secret here.
All right, now we get to the juicy stuff.
All the meat.
This is what everybody's waiting, like, okay, get to the bishops against bishops and cardinals against cardinals. That's what we want to talk about. But it's important that we're
fighting, right?
Yeah, we have to we have to go with what Our Lady said in the order. Because it's kind of like when we get to bishops against bishops, that's what happens when you don't do everything she just said.
Yes. Yeah, so, you don't want a proof text just because it's more interesting. Right. Same point we just made.
Yeah.
About secret two. Yeah, we got to go in order. That's good.
Okay, so let's do this. I'm going to read it, and then you just interrupt me on a point you want to make. Okay, so we're doing now the third message of Our Lady of Akita. This is the juicy one, bishops against bishops. It begins like this, quote, "My dear daughter, listen well to what I have to say to you. You will inform your superior." I'm going to pause here. Again, Our Lady wants the seers and the visionaries to conform to their superiors. This always happens in true apparitions.
Consistently.
Yes. Yep. "As I told you, if men do not repent and better themselves, the Father will inflict a terrible punishment on all of humanity. It will be a punishment greater than the deluge, such as will never have been seen before." Go for it, Tim.
Do you hear what she's saying? I mean, this is a valid apparition accepted by the church, worthy of belief. And she's saying more than the flood, more than the ark. And then just to underscore the emphasis here, to reemphasize, she says, so if you don't know what that means, you know, the flood, Noah's Ark, that was number one before, you know, the covenant made thereafter was a rainbow. So it's not going to be a flood. We're going to find out in a couple lines what this will be. But it's going to be worse than the flood. This is serious business.
Yeah. It reminds me of, you know, in the Gospels that there's a baptism of water and then there's a baptism of fire. It's almost like Noah's flood, the deluge, was the baptism of water. And here we're talking about the baptism of fire, because she goes on to say, quote, "Fire will fall from the sky and will wipe out a great part of humanity, the good as well as the bad, sparing neither priest nor faithful."
Oh, good.
So, hey, priest, just because you're a priest, you're in it, man.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like for people that are holy, but fear a natural death way too much for a holy person. This is just a temperament thing. Sometimes I fall in this category. I can fall in and out of it. But just because, you know, like a friend of mine, well-known Catholic, would always say, like, you know, anxiety is crypto atheism, secret atheism, because it means you're not caring about things the way you should. That's catchy, and I don't disagree. But when I slip into thinking about natural health, natural death too much, I don't think it's that I've slipped into crypto atheism. I think it's just a temperamental thing. You know, I can be a little bit choleric at times where I get anxiety. But the point is that this kind of ends the dispute between those of you out there who might talk about a natural death, you know, good faithful people as something to fear, something to, you can't avoid it. You already knew that much, but now she's specifically tying it back to soteriology. And what she says in 1973 is specifically that, look, your soteriology, your salvation is tied to your good acts, but your good acts will not save you from the natural chastisement of, actually supernatural chastisement of the third part of the Akita secret. If your number's up, you're going to go.
Yeah.
Scary. Good and the bad together. Priests, good priests and bad priests together is what she probably meant to say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then she says the survivors will find themselves so desolate that they will envy the dead. Now, this reminds me of the third secret of Fatima 3A, the part that was revealed, not the part that we don't have, because we see a city, you know, half desolate, bodies everywhere. So remember, folks, Cardinal Ratzinger said that this vision is the same as the third secret of Fatima. And it's at this point where we start to see the overlap.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly.
There's something apocalyptic of dead bodies, destruction, truly, truly seems global.
Right. Well, a city of ruin, remember to go back to 3A from Fatima, a city that's lain half in waste, which is could describe the Roman Empire anytime after like the fourth century. But with assassins all around and with dead bodies all around. This sounds like the kind of situation where the survivors might envy the dead and be like, well, this is really bad. I almost wish I were dead.
Yeah.
The fire from above, if you'll pardon my, you know, gallows laughter, fire from above sounds like you might envy the dead even a little bit more, you know, if the earth is scorched and heaven only knows. It is on par with 3A, but it sounds like an uptick, right? By a distinction of degree, it sounds more.
And by the way, Sister Agnes didn't have access to 3A, right?
Oh yeah, that's true.
Didn't have, when this comes out in 73, 3A is released in 2000.
That's true.
So she's not like, you know, copying or doing anything, you know, that she knows about trying to make her third secret of Akita match the third secret of Fatima. So it's kind of neat, you know, post hoc to see, wow, this stuff lines up.
And also, since we're pointing out context, that's a good point. I'd never really put that little historical trivia together. It ends up being important. Also, I believe she was the only member of her Buddhist family to convert. So It's not like you got this, oh, Fatima, Akita, Lourdes, La Salette, from your mom, like she got it from her
great
mom,
aunt.
The way many people, yeah, from her great aunt. It's all new. It's as new as the gospel is to her. It's as foreign to her, a Japanese woman, as the gospel would have been.
That's a good point.
She's not a cradle Catholic. We can say that much certainly. Whether or not any other members of her family converted, I can't say with certainty. I'm just going on memory. But yeah, it's a different thing fundamentally for an adult convert to be the seer. It's just a hell of a thing.
Well, my mind, you know, runs back to Our Lady of Guadalupe. We have Juan Diego. He's an adult convert. He converts later in his life, I think, you know, after his wife even dies. So he's 40s,
yes.
50s. I don't know the exact age, but he's a convert and Our Lady chooses him. So again, not a cradle. His mind isn't imposed with all kinds of things that he's learned growing up. Just Catholic culture that we, you know, suck in as sponges for kids of all the Marian apparitions and the catechisms and all that. Like you said, blank slate, totally new.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes a difference.
So the next part, she says, quote, the only arms which will remain for you will be the rosary and the sign left by my son. Each day, recite the prayer of the rosary. With the rosary, pray for the Pope, bishops, and priests. The work of the devil will infiltrate even into the church in such a way that one will see cardinals opposing cardinals and bishops against other bishops. I'll pause there. Tim, this is the good part.
This is the money shot, really. Yeah. I mean, I guess to start at the beginning, the sign left by her son, could I be either be the sign of the cross, right? The crucifix. It could be, I mean, we wouldn't say, if in the sense of like signs and wonders, what we used to call the miracles in the gospel could be anything. I always thought of it as the cross. What do you think it is?
Well, I think, you know, signum in Latin, like the sign, is either the sign of the cross that we make at every prayer, but sometimes it's used for the creed. So it might be the creed or the profession of the faith. I don't know. I mean, I think back to how the Japanese for, you know, I think it was over 100 years, the church existed without priests. So they would just baptize and marry one another, and they would recite the creed and recite the rosary because all the missionaries were kicked out of Japan. And so it's like she says, the only arms which will remain are the rosary and the sign left by my son. So it's almost like in this period, you may not have masses or confirmation or... Maybe you, I don't even know. You know, it's all you have is the sign and the rosary.
I hope that's not
the case, but
yeah,
she's saying
maybe it is.
Your tool belt is greatly restricted. But she says, pray the rosary. And she says, pray the rosary for the Pope, the bishops, and the priests. The work of the devil will infiltrate even into the church.
Smoke of Satan. Now that a similar parsing of an almost identical phrase had been selected and used not a full year before this by Pope Paul VI. Remember, in late 1972, when he says, "By some fissure, the smoke of Satan has entered the sanctuary." Strange. Everyone's getting the point. Now, this is 3 years after the new Mass has been released. Make of that what you will.
Eight years after Vatican II closes.
8 years after the close of Vatican II, all of the funny business, and I mean this in the most serious sense, ironically, in terms of what happened between the close of the Second Vatican Council in 1965 and the actual release of the new Mass, think of how much chicanery, subterfuge was happening in those 5 years, right? In those 5 years between 65 and 70, you have Louis Bouillet and Cardinal Ratzinger, two friends who had been on the concilium to write the new Mass from the council document, Sacrosanctum Concilium, coming forward and telling Pope Paul VI, Holiness, this guy you put in charge of the concilium, Bunini, he's whack. Everyone look him up out there. He's totally bonkers.
Maybe a Freemason.
He's going off the rails. Maybe a Freemason, which it ends up looking like he was, the guy that wrote the Novus Ordo. And we have to leave. This is such a personal moral crisis. If you don't remove him, then we remove ourselves. So they left the concilium.
I don't like that, Tim. It reminds me of Ratzinger many years later.
It is shades of...
I don't like what's going on. I'm out.
Right, right.
At this point, I think we got to be in there and throw some elbows and win it back. We can't be like those darn, it's kind of like, you know, we talked about it, Halloween and Holy Days. We can't just let the pagans have it and be like, well, I don't like how you're doing that. I'm leaving it. No, people. Like we said, be the Maccabee. Organize your men, go back and take it.
It definitely ain't the Gordon Marshall way, right? Instead of Ratzinger Bouillet, I also respect Louis Bouillet, but same critique of his parallel action. Or Gordon Marshall, I think now with a little bit of history, we know, okay, what you have to do is stay and fight. And I mean, Benedict should have known it by 2013, but then he might have felt it because they went and they started the Communio, right?
Yep.
They went and started a new journal and they were, it was a little bit less like pure retreat. I think staying and fighting is now it's more clear that's what's needed, but they went and they started like an alternate journal and they kind of worked against from outside. So it's arguably, it's not as good. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, this is one of the things that people don't understand. The Pope Benedict, who knows what's going on right now more than anyone. He doesn't have the mind of God, but he knows where the bodies are buried. He knows why he resigned. He knows whether or not, you know, he alone can verify whether Vegano is speaking the truth. He knows that document on the Lavender Mafia. He knows who the Freemasons are in the Vatican. He knows all of the funniness that happened in the late 70s and early 80s. He knows about Fatima. Yeah. He knows everything. And he was in this position, and this happened. It's one of the minor facts, him and Bouyer leaving the concilium, that I think people need to know about. It's easy to overlook. Also, between 65 and 70, you get the rogues getting communion in the hand. You get the... You get the removal of the oath against modernism right before the mass was released in 1969. Pope Paul VI took away the oath against modernism in all the universities and seminaries. That's odd. You get the removal of the St. Michael's prayer for the new mass, you know, at the end, which is a mini exorcism every time. You had the one loss to the libs in the church was 1968 and Humanae Vitae, but even that was he, you know, there were so many other victories afoot for the liberals in the church that they felt like they could openly rebel, and they basically have ever since then, and they never really followed it without any kind of punishment. So it wasn't a pure loss for them because they had a sizable enough majority not to fall. So all this is happening. And then what happens after the new mass is released between 1970 and 72? People, the faith is gutted, right? People stop going to church, 50 to 60% of people.
I'll put the graph on the screen. Look at this, folks. Look at what happens between 1965 and 1975. Look at the young people, how quickly they abandoned the Catholic Church. No more people going to mass. It's so sad. We've talked this before. It's like when Coca-Cola put out New Coke and everybody hated it, they didn't just say New Coke's better, New Coke's better for 50 years. They said, oh, we should go back to our old ways because that's what people liked. Look at these numbers. Look at this graph. It's crazy. So yeah, I like how you kind of published this timeline, Tim. Like 1970, we have the Novus Ordo of the Mass. That was the same year, by the way, that the Society of St. Pius X started with church approval under Archbishop Lefebvre. Everybody always thinks of SSPX as, you know, excommunicated, but they were around for years with approval of Rome as a priestly society. So that happened in 1970 as well. In 1972, Paul VI abolished minor orders.
Oh yeah,
which was a big thing in the seminaries, and then in 73 we had the invention of Eucharistic lay ministers of Holy Communion. So you had
that was 73.
Yeah, so you had lay people actually touching the Eucharist for the first time.
I thought that happened before 70. I just always assumed that's interesting.
It's 1973.
That's 73.
So that's the same year as the Akita visions that we're talking about. And then 77, although it was happening in like Belgium and in Holland and Germany, communion in the hand, it came to America in 1977. So before that, we had communion on the tongue. 1977.
Right.
We
also in the secular world, 1973 is the year of Roe versus Wade. That can't have made Jesus very happy. Yeah, for us. But we're the light of the world, right? I mean, that's the leading nation in the world in terms of moral prowess. And
I don't know.
leading in
good morals and bad morals nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I mean, up until that point, right? I mean, it's the first world nation of first world nations at that point, and that's really when we handed in our badge.
Yeah.
With Roe versus Wade. Wow, I didn't know some of that other stuff.
Yeah, we should maybe do a video. Let us know in the comments. Do you want us to do a video of timeline? I think it'd be really great to do a timeline from, you know, just go through dates from maybe 19, from like maybe Leo the 13th.
That'd be good.
All the way up to our present day of changes and modifications in the College of Cardinals, liturgy, divine office, just to see how we went from in the past 100 years, so much change and where all that happened. So let us know in the comments. You want us to do that? We'll do it.
That'd be a video where less commentary, I think, would be requisite because res ipsa loquitur, right? The facts speak for themselves.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah, boom. Here's what's happened in the last 100 years. I think we should do that. Categorically. Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right, so moving on. So we have cardinals opposing cardinals, bishops against bishops. I mean, we should say something here, Tim. I mean, there were cardinals opposing each other at Vatican II. We know that. We know that bishops were also having words with one another over the mass. You see that with Lefebvre. Lefebvre has deep concerns. He originally had a lot of sympathy within parts of the hierarchy, especially places with seminarians and priests in France, and then extension to America. America really became a leader in that, you know, traditional movement. And then now we're kind of seeing it in the last, since the Dubia brothers came out, we're starting to see it even more. Any other examples that come to mind?
Well, I just want to say I've always strongly felt since the even before the time of the Dubia brothers, since 2014, 2015, since you had, say, Cardinal Burke and others, Impel, and them sending their little essays to all of the Synod Fathers in 2014 and the Vatican Post Office trying to gut it and they're having to sneak them. That was the first time I really looked at Akita. I was like, this must be what they're talking about. And all of the fallout from 2014. I mean, remember, let's do a little timeline. What was happening in 2014, you had the four Dubia brothers, and Cardinal Cafaro would always mention these words, bishops against bishops and cardinals against cardinals.
I remember that. Yes. He was citing Akita. Yes.
He's citing Akita, and he's saying, this is what's happening now. He received a personal letter in the 80s from Sister Lucy of Fatima, and she said, she told him something about bishops versus bishops. You know, yeah, everyone knows it by now. And she also used the expression that the final Satan's final attack would come on the family. So that there's a lot of info packed into that bit of that line. And so you combine those two facts that it's going to be a bitter struggle between bishops and their confreres, and the idea that the struggle will come over the family, and then all of a sudden you have the synod on the family and a bitter struggle between a minority of good guys and what appears to be a majority of bad guys, ostensibly anyway. And I've always strongly said Akita in its third part. I think this is the key line for our times. Really is talking about not even Vatican II, but the full instantiation, the full embodiment of Vatican II, which has begun in 2014, I'd say, the second year of the Francis papacy. That's what I've always thought.
Yeah. And last week when we did our video on the USCCB meeting, we were pointing out that there are bishops who are standing up and saying, why do you have a guy like James Martin going into your diocese? So we're seeing bishops starting to call each other out. It's in America, it's more subtle. It's not like Cardinal Cafaro, but I think we're starting to see it. And it'll be really interesting to see what USCCB meeting 2019 looks like. If more bishops start to say, you know what, we got to start being apostolic. We got to start being vocal and explicit about what's wrong, not just making generalities.
I mean, people out there who have watched these videos, everyone knows what I want, right? I want them being more than apostolic. I want them being prophetic. I want them standing and yelling if they need to do so at these meetings. You know, yelling, shouting the gospel against the walls if that's what is required.
Yeah.
Good for all the bishops that said the right things, you know, earlier this week. But it's like there is a way of saying the right thing as tepidly, as gingerly as you can, you know. And so you're like, okay, this goes down on text, but I was basically whispering this. I feel like I strongly intuit that's what was happening, and even the words weren't that tough. So again, I'm not, beggars can't be choosers. We'll take the heroes as they appear, but I'd like a more angry fashioning of a hero that's gonna. I'd like him. I mean, according to Akita, this is going to be a real conflict. I'd like it to get a little hotter, a bit hotter. Yes. I want the whole world ashamed of itself, which is, you know, you got to have some profits if I'm to get what I want here. So, yeah, let's see it. Let's see what you got.
I was thinking, you know, when Cardinal Mahoney, the criminal, stands up in front of the USCCB and lectures everybody on abuse, when he's paid out $720 million, I'm like, every one of you bishops has a crozier. That thing, that somebody on the left side of the stage should have put that out and gone around his neck and dragged right. him off like in the old comedies, right? Like, you're a dud, dude. We got our crook, and we're pulling you off the stage, but didn't happen. Maybe next year it'll happen.
Right.
So Cardinals against Cardinals, Bishops against Bishops, and then she goes on to say, by the way, we have now moved beyond 3A, first part of the third secret of Fatima, and we're now getting into some teaching, and this is what I think 3B actually says.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right? good you pointed that
so
out.
So I think if Akita, this third message of Akita, is the same as the third secret of Fatima, we are now getting into 3B, the text, the words of Our Lady at this point. We're moving into the transition. She says
exactly what I think. Yeah.
The priests who venerate me will be scorned and opposed by their confreres, churches and altars sacked. The church will be full of those who accept compromises, and the demon will press many priests and consecrated souls to leave the service of the Lord. The demon will be especially implacable against souls consecrated to God. That's the religious. The thought of the loss of so many souls is the cause of my sadness. If sins increase in number and gravity, there will be no longer pardon for them. With courage, speak to your superior. He will know how to encourage each one of you to pray and to accomplish works of reparation. I'll pause there. Churches and altars are going to be sacked and desecrated.
They already had been, right?
There have been. Yeah, I mean, what was that, in Italy? Was it Milan? It was Venice. I think it was Venice. This Muslim guy got up on the high altar and started dancing and breakdancing. His friend videoed it, you know?
Dope.
Yeah, crazy. In Ireland, there was a priest fornicating with another man, I think it was, on an altar. I mean,
really?
So these things are happening, but I think this is not just talking about a handful of things. I think it's going to be systematic.
Well, what I meant is you spoke with Father Dwight recently, right?
Longenecker. Father Dwight Longenecker.
Yeah. And Father Longenecker wrote an amazing, but it's not even that long. He just had all the right pictures, and it was about pre-VC2 altars and post-VC2 altars. And it was just a bunch of pictures. And then he had some really great one-liners in there right around 2015, right on the second synod. And that, I forget what the piece is called. I've looked it up recently. I can't remember it. It was just really good. I should email him. But that's the sacking. Sacking has this term too, right? The sacking of altar. It's like the, you know, the Colosseum was not originally known as a limestone structure, right? It was marble, and they pulled all of the finery off of it. That's the
right.
I think the primary meaning of sacking. So the altars had already been sacked by this 1973. I don't know if all around the world it was such a thorough thing, but now it's pretty much 99% of churches have none of the fine metals, none of the hardware.
Italy, you've been to Italy a lot. You've been to Europe, Tim. I have too. You go into these amazing Romanesque Baroque churches, the detail and the expense to put these churches and cathedrals together is unparalleled. You walk in there, the high altar is just, you want to pass out. Even they have some lame IKEA particle wood altar that's positioned 30 feet out from the high altar, floating there in the transept, and you're like, we need to lynch somebody. Who put the IKEA? This altar was made out of plywood or particle wood, and it took one day to make and about $600, and it's just junk.
And you tell me that's not diabolical, what you're describing?
It's bad.
Putting junky IKEA furniture in the place of gold hardware in the background?
Yeah.
That is the work of the devil. Who were these people? Sorry, baby boomers.
Yeah.
The people on watch during the 70s and 80s, what is the matter with you? All right, I had to get that out. But
yeah, that's like on Thanksgiving,
someone.
My wife, you know, puts out the fine china that we got for our wedding, and the silver and the candlesticks and everything, like, goes all out. She spends days getting all polishing the silver with the girls and all that. And then I come in for Thanksgiving and I say, oh, wow, that's great, but we're not going to use that. She's like, what? And like, yeah, I bought this card table from Home Depot, and we're gonna eat on that with plates.
With Dixie cups.
Yeah.
With paper plates and
red
Dixie cups.
Would she be offended? Yes. What do you mean?
Like, should she be?
Yeah.
Yes.
And why is my wife doing all of that? Because she loves our family and she wants to celebrate it. She's thankful. It's Thanksgiving. Eucharistia. Thank you.
Right.
She's saying thank you to God. And when we say thank you to God, we try to give him our best.
That's
and
right.
That's what Catholics did for 2,000 years. They said, you know what? I'm going to take grandma's wedding ring and melt it down and give it to the church, you know? Or I'm going to go and volunteer and chisel marble, you know? Or,
right.
or donate marble or give our best so that for generations we have these glorious churches. And you go to Europe now and it's just sad.
It's sad. That's a great analogy because people watching this think, oh, no one would do this. You know, no one would actually come in with Dixie cups and paper plates, say, this is what we're going to do. This is what they were doing in the 70s. And it had already done some before Akita. And what they did, I think, at an accelerating rate after Akita, they took all this beautiful, the beautiful altars, and they sacked them like a bunch of Vandals and Visigoths. It's disgusting. And again, shame on the people that sat by and saw this. Sorry. Shame on that generation. What is the matter with you? How could you watch? I'm this mad, and I'm mad hearing that once our churches didn't look like Applebee's, right?
Yep.
Most suburban churches are actually – no, I got it wrong. They're framed more like a macaroni grill, right? A lot of them have the flagstone and the set that 70s look. I was like, wait, am I waiting? Are you going to serve me like an appetizer if I'm waiting here? Like, why does it look like this? And then that's just how it's been my whole life, aside from when I go to the Latin Mass. But the people, can you imagine how mad, and I get mad. Can you imagine if you had actually been 10, 20 years in the church with the beautiful, just the real church?
A lot of people were mad. A lot of people left.
I know. It's hard not to imagine myself being one of the people that I'm glad that I was born a couple generations later because I get this mad over just looking back. How could you not? I don't know. I don't want to say something.
Well, I mean, look what she says. She says churches and altars will be sacked. The very next line, the church will be full of those who accept compromises. And the demon will press many priests and consecrated souls to leave the service of the Lord.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, people either they accept compromise or just say, I'm out. I'm not going to serve the Lord anymore. It's too crazy.
I'm sick of company,
and you know,
man.
You know, Tim, since we've been doing these videos together, I've heard from a lot of priests. And they're saying, we priests, my brother priests, we are so discouraged right now.
Really?
We are so discouraged. And so I just want to ask all the people out there, pray for our priests. You think us lay people were discouraged? I mean, these guys have given up and they've fought through some pretty crappy seminary situations to become ordained priests and to serve us and to serve the Lord. So pray for the priests and for all you father priests out there. We're praying for you. We love you. Keep fighting the fight.
Keep fighting.
Do not let the demon depress many priests to leave the service of the Lord.
Yeah, there's a certain aesthetics about this, right? I mean, think of a really touching drama. I mean, why do we love Rocky One? It's one of the Thanksgiving movies
deep.
I always watch.
It's getting deep.
Like the cinema time.
Yeah.
No, I mean we like it because it's an underdog. Like that's what the holy priests are. They're underdog fighters.
Yes.
Nothing is more inspiring to a man than an underdog fighter. That doesn't care. It's like he's giving a middle finger to all the bad guys. And he's like, I don't care. Like you can, you know, all I want to do is go the distance. The famous Rocky thing. I just want to fight my fight. To use St. Paul's expression, I want to run my course. And you know what? Like you can, this is what I think about all of y'all. Like that's what those you need daily inspiration to do your job. And these priests need daily encouragement, not only from one another, but from the lay saying, hey, that's great. Be angry. Fight. The angrier you are, the prouder we are of
preach
you.
It. That's, preach it. Preach
yeah,
it.
Yeah, preach it. Robert Bellarmine, man.
Preach it.
Righteous anger. Just do it. We need the righteous anger. We don't need to mince words. We don't have to say, well, I'm preaching this in charity. It's like, no, forget that. There's a time and a place for
you
all things.
You don't say
this
we're going to lead. We're going to lead with beauty or all these things. No, just give it to us straight. Talk like Jesus. Talk like John the Baptist. So, and then she says, you know, the thought of the loss of so many souls is the cause of my sadness. So
what does that mean? Loss?
Loss of souls. Loss of souls.
But no one goes to hell, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, dare we hope. Dare we hope.
Dare we hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Balthazar. It's garbage. It's garbage.
Pure garbage. If you hear priest, says Mary.
Mary. In Akita and in Fatima. If you hear priests saying that, don't listen to those priests. There, I said
and
it.
Talk, and talk to them after Mass and be like, hey, wrong guy. You ever heard of Akita or Fatima or the Gospels?
Yeah, or the Blessed.
The answer is no.
Blessed Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the Book of Revelation, which depicts people in hell.
Right.
So it's all there. And this is kind of, you know, this is the closing part, Tim, where she says, speak to your superior. Again, just like she said to Juan Diego, you know, go and talk to the bishop-elect of Mexico City.
Right.
Go. We gotta make this regular, you know.
Just like she informed Lucy at Fatima, she's like, I don't want you revealing this to anyone except your bishop if you're sick or whatever the caveat was. She always says to operate. Now, this is, can we talk about this some?
Yeah, because the Sede Vacantist, they're not going to really jive with this. They're like, no.
They don't jive with it. And it's difficult because, like, when the message is that the majority of bishops will turn, right? There will be, the devil will work into the church, the smoke of Satan, and will convert, I guess, a strong majority to the bad side.
It's interesting. She calls it the demon.
That is interesting.
It's kind of an interesting way of speaking there. Anyway.
Well, I wonder why not.
She doesn't say Lucifer. She says the demon.
Right.
The demon will be especially implacable. So she's, anyway, just interesting. Right. I don't have anything to say about it. It's noteworthy.
It is noteworthy. But I mean, you see what I'm saying, where it's like, there is not to sound like a sede, far be it from me to sound like a sede, but it is interesting that there's not a contradiction here, but there's a little bit of tension between, hey, the hierarchy is going to get corrupted. And then a prime part of the message is, and work within the hierarchical structure.
Talk to your superior.
Talk to your superiors. I mean, I'm kind of connecting Akita and Fatima more, but it's like, it is also interesting that whatever we think happened with 3B and cover up, not cover up, what's a nicer word than cover up? Go find a euphemism. Somewhere.
Mental reservation.
Mental reservation, Antonio Socci. Oh, we want to talk to you, Antonio Socci. Yes. You're a good dude. But so all of this aside, she's saying work within the church. And it's kind of miraculous that the church approved both Akita and Fatima, isn't it? Given that it's like there is this tension. You're critiquing the hierarchy and you're asking the hierarchy to ratify the document.
That's because there's people in the hierarchy who realize that it is true.
Yes.
Like Ratzinger.
Yes.
They look around and they see churches sacked. They see altars sacked. They see religious confused and discouraged and despairing. And, you know, they say, yeah, well, we need to push this one through so people know.
That's true.
Hey, there's one thing that came to mind real quick. We were talking about the sacking of churches and I lost the thought, but it just came back to me. Have you noticed when you were in, especially in Italy, I noticed it in Italy a lot. There's these altars, you know, these IKEA altars, and they don't put the candles on each end of the altar. They put them both on the one end of the altar. Have you noticed this?
Oh, yeah, I did.
They do. Funny. It drives me crazy, you know?
Why do – it's I'm so like, asymmetrical. Yeah.
They put – and you see it sometimes in America. Probably priests who went to Europe and like, oh, that's cool. I should do that. But it's just – you're in this church where everything is symmetrical and it's been designed that way, like a Platonic form. And then there's just this – record screech right in the middle of the vision of it all, of this IKEA altar, and then the candlesticks are like on one end of the altar together.
Yeah.
And then sometimes there's a plant on the other end. It's like, what, who is doing this?
I've never seen the plant, but that's
demonic.
That's genuinely funny. So we lived in San Lorenzo, which is the tiny little neighborhood about a mile east of the Colosseum. And we were actually between the square formed by the corners of San Lorenzo, Santa Maria Maggiore. Santa Croce was really close. It was actually even closer than San Lorenzo.
I like that church. Was neighborhood. Yeah.
That's my favorite church.
Is that your favorite?
That's my favorite. And then San Giovanni, which it faces, the church is built by Constantine and his mother. I trained for the Rome Marathon. I ran that ovular park between San Giovanni and Santa Croce. It was dope. But the Muslims
I ran the gelato cup.
Did you?
You know what the gelato cup is?
No, I don't.
My son and I did it with American seminarians. So around Vatican City is, I think it's a little over 2 miles. And it's uphill one side, downhill the other side. And you run around a nation because Vatican City State is a nation.
That's hilarious.
And whoever wins it gets a giant cup full of gelato just down the street at Old Bridge.
An Irish priest told me about it, but he just said that he was running.
And some people who are joggers, when they're in Rome, they'll go and run around Vatican City just to say, I ran around a country.
That's funny.
So we run it, and I never won it. My son got pretty close. He's a pretty fast runner, but some of the seminarians were in good shape, good runners. But so I can't claim the Rome Marathon, just the gelato cup around the walls.
Gelato Marathon.
Around the walls of Vatican City, because Vatican City doesn't have walls.
That's right. 21 feet.
Yeah. Big walls.
Yeah. But I only would ever see the off-centered, one-sided candle at our little local parish. But usually we went to either Santa Croce, San Lorenzo, San
Maria. What was the local parish that you would go to?
I forget. It was literally just around. We were lucky enough to live almost right above like a smallish American-style grocery, which was just sheer good luck because we didn't want to like shop 7 times a week like the Romans. So right behind that was just a little parish, and it was literally all like 80-year-olds and above. And they thought it was so neat to have two like bambini, you know, two middle twenties aged couple that was married in their 20s. They'd call when Steph got pregnant out there with our first daughter. They would call her a ragazza madre, like a child mother. It's like she's like, you know, middle 20s, and the arrested development is staggering. But
yeah, it's sad.
Yeah, so I only said you just reminded me of something I hadn't thought of in a long time. I've never seen that in America, by the way.
Of what?
The staggered candle.
It's very rare, but I've seen it here. But
it's a poser priest.
Some Monsignor went to Italy and got a good idea by seeing it. But in Italy, it's all over the place. It's like the trendy thing to do since 1989 is to put the candles on one end. Everyone out there in the comments, if you've seen this, just let me know. I think it's an interesting phenomenon. I'm trying to figure out who thought of this. Asymmetry.
So weird.
It's so weird. So, okay, well, let's just finish up unless you got something more to say about candle. Okay. So he says, it is Bishop Ito who directs your community. So again, we're talking about a bishop here. You have still something to ask? Today is the last time that I will speak to you in a living voice. From now on, you will obey the one sent to you and your superior. Pray very much the prayers of the rosary. I alone am able to save you from the calamities which approach. Those who place their confidence in me will be saved. End quote. End of Our Lady of Akita. So just a really sweet admonition to be faithful to your superior and your bishop.
Right. Which is not always the sound like the takeaway of what we're saying here, but it is. It actually is. Working it out is a little bit complex, and that's why we have hour and a half shows. But it is.
Right.
We still work as lay. Parish priests still work as ordained men within a hierarchical structure. We're not Marxists. We're not advocating getting rid of the hierarchy. We want to prop up and dignify. Redignify the hierarchy. Make the church holy again.
Yes, make the church holy again. Got to get those hats. Who wants to make the church holy again hat?
I think it'd be dope.
It'd be great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there it is. Our Lady of Akita. If you have any suggestions for future shows, let us know in the comments. And of course, as we always say, please like this video. Why like it? Because if you like it, that tells the YouTube robots to share this video around on YouTube and more people will see it. So if you want more people to see this, go ahead and hit like. Also, you can hit the share button and share it on Facebook. You can text it to someone else. Just let other people know about it because a lot of people are confused and they need some direction. They need to know what the words of Our Lady are, Akita, Fatima, and everything going on in the church. So please like it, share it, subscribe to the channel, and hit the little bell. That'll notify you every time we have a new video out. And thanks for watching. God bless you. And we will always say, pray the rosary.
Daily.
Let it be known. that Tim and Taylor say, pray the rosary. It is the weapon for our time. It is the gospel on beads. It is meditating on the gospels of Jesus Christ. The birth, the life, the death, the resurrection, the glorious ministry of Jesus Christ. All right. God bless everyone. See you in the next video.